founded by John Heath and George Abecassis, the HWM racing team set out in 1950, the year of the first F1 World Championship, to race its Formula 2 cars all over Europe in a unique British endeavour. Always run on a shoestring, the single-seaters achieved great results in flying the flag for their mainly British drivers, including a very young Stirling Moss. It is the subject of a new book called John George in the 8 and the HWMs. It's by established and well-regarded motor racing journalist and commentator Simon Taylor, and I'm delighted to be joining me live on the line, Simon himself. Simon, good afternoon to you.
Hello, good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us on this Friday afternoon. It's one of the first teams. When you think of British racing successes and teams, you think perhaps Vanwall, Lotus, Williams, those sort of teams. But this was indeed the first team to set out to fly the flag for Britain.
Well, it really was. I mean, I've called the book, the subtitle of the book, is The First Racing Team to Fly the Flag for Britain. And although there had been British cars racing abroad before that, Napier before the First World War, Sunbeam, ERA, none of them were really setting about a complete season with a large team of cars. John Heath, who started this team, was extremely ambitious. He had no money, but nevertheless, he wanted to run a fully-fledged racing team around Europe. And they ran usually three cars, sometimes even four. And the way racing worked in those days was that if you turned up, you got paid start money by the organisers. So you would say to a race organiser, okay, I will bring you three cars, you will pay me £300 per car, so you will pay me £900. And what the team did, in a couple of terrible old trucks, one of them was a broken down, cut down, double-decker bus, and they squeezed three cars into that, and then the other was an ex-World War II army truck, and they squeezed a car in that, and it also towed a trailer with 100 gallons of fuel in. And this was the extraordinary little convoy that went around Europe, maximum speed on the flat, about 30 miles an hour, and they would go from Sweden one weekend to Italy the next weekend, enormous mileages done by the mechanics, who usually never had any sleep and were paid virtually nothing. And once the cars got to the track, they would do the practice, what we now call qualifying, on the Friday and Saturday, and provided they survived qualifying and got on the starting grid and did one lap, even if they broke down or crashed on lap two, they would get their start money. If they didn't complete one racing lap, they wouldn't get the start money. And the way these people were running so hand-to-mouth that they would need one weekend start money to fill up petrol in the trucks to get them to the next race. And then if the cars broke down in practice or they didn't, for whatever reason, make the start, then they wouldn't have any money to get to the next race. And that's really how it works. And when we think of modern Formula One with these huge gleaming trucks going from race to race, the mechanics probably flying in aeroplanes there because it's just a truckie who drives the truck, and you have racing drivers being paid £250,000 a week or more, I mean it's up in the sort of football league, these people were doing it for pennies. And nevertheless, as my book shows, they had an absolute ball. They had all sorts of crises and crashes and breakdowns and dramas, but as Stirling Moss said, and he wrote the foreword for my book, we just had a lot of dramas but a lot of fun. And this was what motor racing was like in the 1950s. It was fun. It wasn't the deadly serious multi-million pound business that it is today.
I mean, one of the things that, you know, you can draw a parallel as well is because of the 1948, 1949, which is when I think the team first started to get together.
You're only
a few years after the war as well, and there's a sort of, you're flying the flag for Britain, you're racing for your country, and there's that sort of, and several journalists have made this comparison between drivers and fighter pilots as well.
Well, that's absolutely true, and George Abecassis, John Heath's partner, was actually a very brave bomber pilot in the war, got a double DFC, and in the end was shot down over Denmark, actually, and tried to walk back to freedom, and in the end was caught and spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp. But after the war, these people who had lived extremely exciting lives, very dangerous lives, maybe flying fighters or even fighting at the front, England, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, was a pretty grey and dismal place come 1945. The country was worn out. There was rationing. Nobody seemed to have anything very much. And it was a very austere, meagre time. And in that, you had these drivers, these people like George Abecassis, who'd raced before the war, who'd then flown his bombers, and suddenly it was 1945, and he had nothing to do, and he wanted to have some fun again. And that's how the HWM team was started, between John Heath and George Abecassis, because George Abecassis wanted to get back into racing, and John Heath wanted to run his own racing team. And the two of them got together. They had a little garage in Walton-on-Thames, just by the River Bridge, and they bought and sold cars. They did servicing. They did anything they could to scratch together enough money to build the cars over the winter. And having built them, and they built new cars for each season, having built the cars, they then tried to make it work, going from race to race from March until October. And just about they got away with it. It was only when they got to about 1954, when the cars were still pretty primitive. They were a bit heavy, they were a bit underpowered, they used a lot of production car components to save money, and by 1954, Formula One was beginning to become more sophisticated. Mercedes came in, and Ferrari were producing wonderful cars, and really HWM couldn't compete anymore. And so then what they did was they converted their old unsold Formula 2 single-seaters into Jaguar engine sports cars. They actually used the same chassis twice, typical way of how they managed to get a quart out of a pint pot. And they converted their cars into sports racing cars with Jaguar engines, and they did very well with those from 54, 55, and into 56. And it only really went wrong when John Heath, who hadn't been doing so much driving of late, he'd been running the team and running the business, he decided that he wanted to do the Mille Miglia, which is the 1,000-mile road race around Italy. George Abecassis had done it a couple of times. He said to John Heath, I don't really think you should do this because it's a very dangerous race. You don't really have the experience of racing of this sort. John said, I'll be fine. I want to do it. So off they went to Italy to do the Mille Miglia, John Heath with his HWM Jaguar, and he must have had some sort of premonition, because the night before the race, he sat down and wrote out on a sheet of old paper a new will. And the will begins, because of the dangers of motor racing, I hereby set out my last will and testament. And I've managed to find a facsimile of that will, which of course I put in the book. And he wrote that will out at about 10 o'clock at night. At 3 o'clock the next morning he had to get up to go to the start. He started the race. His car started, they used to start at 1 minute intervals. His car started at 5:45. It was raining. He set off from Brescia in northern Italy, where the 1,000-mile race traditionally began, and an hour and a half later, in the pouring rain at over 100 miles an hour, going through a little village, the car skidded off the road. He was very badly injured and taken to a local hospital, and he got pneumonia. He had smashed ribs and a lot of lung damage, and he died on the Wednesday. And once John Heath had died, that tragic accident, that really took the stuffing out of the HWM team. George Abecassis gave up motor racing on the spot, and although they still ran the cars for about a year after then, mainly renting them out to other drivers, in the end the whole thing stopped by the end of 57. But HWM still exists because they carried on that business near the bridge at Walton-on-Thames, and remarkably, it still exists. It's now a thriving Aston Martin dealership. It's actually been an Aston Martin dealership since John Heath's day in the 1950s. So it's the oldest Aston Martin dealer in the world and one of the most successful. So HWM still exists. They've still got the same badge over the door that the racing cars ran. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, because people know, most people know, that HWM is an Aston Martin dealer. Very few people remember that actually it was the first successful British racing team, and it did it in this romantic shoestring way, which has produced lots of good stories and anecdotes for my book.
Well, when you think about it, they're taking on, you know, teams such as Mercedes came back in sports car racing and absolutely obliterated everybody. You had the Ferrari, the Maseratis as well, mixing it in, especially in the Formula One. And of course, in 1950, 1951, Formula One and Formula Two were racing together. It wasn't divided in the way that it is now between F1 and GP2, for example.
Exactly, that's quite right. In fact, Formula 1 and Formula 2 cars ran together in 50 and 51, mainly because there were only two teams that were doing Formula 1 seriously. In those days, it was Ferrari and Alfa Romeo. And so Formula 2 cars used to run in the Formula 1 races. And then in 52 and 53, the Formula 2 became the world championship because there weren't enough Formula One cars to go round. But in 50 and 51, the young Stirling Moss, he was 20 when he joined HWM, and HWM was the first drive that he ever had that wasn't in his own little cars. It was the first kind of grown-up drive that he ever had. And immediately, he was absolutely brilliant. And there were Formula One races where he had his little green Formula Two HWM, which had much less horsepower and was built largely out of other people's bits, and he had it up with the Ferraris, up slipstreaming the Ferraris, occasionally getting ahead of them. The front cover of my book is a painting of a famous race in Genoa in 1951, where the works Ferraris were there, obviously in the front row of the grid because they were fastest in qualifying and they were pretty much going to walk the race. And the two HWMs, driven by Stirling Moss and Lance Macklin, somehow managed to catch the Ferraris napping at the start and went into the lead. And this painting, which we got the great motor racing artist Michael Turner to do, shows Moss and Macklin. It's a track rather like Monaco. It's by the seaside round a port. And Moss and Macklin are leading the three red Ferraris. It's the most fantastic sight. Macklin in second place was then passed by certainly two of the Ferraris. Moss stayed out in front for half the race, and then, alas, the car broke. But at least he'd shown everybody what HWM could do. And, of course, they'd earned the start money, so they were able to get to the next race.
Well, also what you've done with the book, it's a two-volume book. One, you sort of detail the history of the racing team itself, and you know, through F1 and F2 and the sports cars. But the second thing you've done is you've detailed the people who are involved in the team. And from that team, you can see how, if you like, it founded the foundation stone for the British success that was to happen in the late 50s and, of course, the 60s. I mean, people like Al Francis. Now, though, if you were a mechanic, Al Francis was perhaps the capo de the capo of all mechanics, wasn't he?
He absolutely was, and the story is in the book, which is sort of strange but true, that Al Francis, who was actually a Polish immigrant, he crossed Europe on foot, gone from Poland to Portugal, trying to get to England because he wanted to fight for the Free Polish Army. Real character. And in 1945, he got a job working in a garage. He knew very little about cars, but he was a sharp bloke, and he managed to learn how to service Ford Populars and Austin Sevens. But he was very bored, and he answered an advertisement which was put in one of the magazines by John Heath, saying they wanted a racing mechanic. And it said, racing mechanic required, experience essential, foreign languages a help. Well, Al Francis spoke about six languages, which he'd learned on the hoof in the war, ducking and diving.
Right.
Not only had he never been a racing mechanic, so he didn't have any experience, he'd actually never seen a racing car. And several people answered the advertisement. And because Al Francis, he was working somewhere in southeast London, and he'd never been across London before, he got lost. He arrived for his job interview after everybody else had gone home, but managed to persuade John Heath to interview him. And he then confessed to John Heath that he'd not only never been a racing mechanic, he'd never been to a motor race, he'd never even seen a racing car. But John Heath must have seen something in him, because he said, well, I'll take you into the workshop and I'll show you a couple of racing cars. And they hired him, and he became absolutely the sort of guiding light for in the workshop. He was always there working night and day. He was always driving the trucks across Europe. In the end, he fell out because he had a pretty sharp temper. And he and John Heath fell out and he went on elsewhere. But he remained a racing mechanic and he ended up working again with Stirling Moss going on into the 1960s. Mm. So that is an example that not only did John Heath give a chance to youngsters who'd barely been heard of, like Stirling Moss and Peter Collins and Lance Macklin, but he also brought on young mechanics as well. Part of the reason for spotting youngsters who looked as though they were going to be a good bet was that because they were newcomers, they were cheap.
Yeah.
And a lovely quote we've got from John Heath himself, when the lads were working until 4 a.m, 6 days a week, one of them had the temerity to say to John Heath, you know, you're paying us 30 shillings a week. Do you think you could pay us a bit of overtime? And John Heath said, I can't afford to pay you overtime. I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you fish and chips each evening and a packet of 10 Woodbines.
That would work. I can see Lewis Hamilton absolutely leaping at that one. But an incredible, if you look at the driver roster, just going through the book, you've got Stirling Moss, you've got Duncan Hamilton, and correct me if I'm wrong, went on to win Le Mans for Aston Martin. Was it Aston Martin? Jaguar or Aston Martin?
Yes, he won Le Mans for Jaguar, absolutely.
Lance Macklin, who was involved in that terrible accident in 55.
Yes.
Jack Fairman, who was, you know, another great racer, lived to a ripe old age. And Peter Collins, I mean, filled with film star looks, great mates, of course, with Mike Hawthorne, and again, a young talent who was sadly taken from us too young.
Well, absolutely. He was killed, as we know, in 1958. And a great Formula One driver for Ferrari. And he started with HWM. One of the other things, of course, that I found out doing, I've pretty much been researching this book, although it took me 3 years to write, I've been researching it for more than 10 years, because I bought my own HWM.
Yes,
19 years ago. But when I did all the research for the book, what I kept coming across was not only the races and the race results and the specifications for the cars and what colour they all were and what happened to them, because that was comparatively easy to discover. What was really amazing was the stories around the people. And I always think that any sport, even motor racing, is not about the cars, it's about the people. And there were broken marriages under rather dramatic circumstances for both John Heath and George Abacasis. There were all sorts of stories and ducking and diving and transporters crashing in the middle of the night and people going into petrol stations at 4 a.m. getting the trucks filled up and then driving away because they had no money and trying to get down the road before the police came. I mean, so much stuff about the people. So if any of your listeners are rich enough to trot out the £130, which I'm afraid this book costs because it is two volumes and 528 pages in a slipcase, they will find not only stories about motor races, that they're all in there, but they'll find stories about people and dramas and arguments and tragedies, particularly the tragedy of how John Heath died, which occupies a chapter and a half of the book, because when you dig into it, the whole circumstances of it were quite extraordinary.
Mm. I mean, the following year, of course, Portego has his big accident at the same circuit, and the race is then, you know, it doesn't run again in its format. I mean, I know it's come back now as a classic historic race, but, I mean, in those days, they were full-blooded racing cars racing around the very narrow street, Italian roads, public roads.
It was phenomenally dangerous because it was 1,000 miles around Italy. There's no way you can control the crowd. People didn't have to pay to watch it, obviously. And you would get, going through a little Italian town, you would get the whole population of the town hanging from windows, standing by the side of the road. Mm. What some of them used to do was stand in the middle of the road. They'd kind of play chicken. And then they would try to get out of, you know, they'd try and stay in the middle of the road until the cars were almost upon them and then dart out of the way, the young lads showing off to their girlfriends. And in 1956, the year that John Heath was killed, because it was raining, I think, without checking the book, I may not have these figures quite right, but I think five drivers were killed and about nine spectators were killed. Mm. And the following year, of course, as you say, the notorious De Portago accident, there were several other accidents in that race, but De Portago was about 80 miles away from the finish in a works Ferrari, going down a straight piece of road. It was absolutely straight, so he was doing 180 miles an hour, but there were people lined each side, and a tyre burst, and he went into the crowd, and I think from memory about a dozen people were killed, mm. spectators. He was killed too, of course. But about five of those spectators were small children, and that really did focus the mind of the authorities in Italy. And on the Tuesday after the race, the Italian Parliament met, and the race was banned forever.
Who did you speak to then? I mean, you've said you've researched this book ever since sort of buying a HMM yourself. Who did you speak to? Did you go back through old records? Were you actually able to speak to probably Stirling, but anybody else who was around at the time?
Indeed. I mean, I certainly spoke to Stirling. I mean, he's a good friend. I've done a book with him already anyway, so he's shown me lots of his scrapbooks and his notes and diaries about his time with HWM. Various other people. I mean, obviously most of them from the 1950s have gone, but a couple of wonderful people who actually worked at HWM as mechanics, lovely man called Rex Woodgate, who then went on to a very good career with Aston Martin, but he was a young lad at HWM, and then a tremendous fellow who had actually been working as the designer in the aircraft industry, and he had a friend who was a mechanic at HWM, and he called in one day just to say hello one evening, and John Heath and the other and the mechanics were all kneeling on the workshop floor with a piece of string and a piece of chalk, and they were drawing out the design for their next year's chassis. And, of course, the longer they went on, the more blunt the chalk became, and therefore the more inaccurate their measurements became. But that's how they used to make the cars, you know, with string and chalk. And this chap, Eugene Dunn, from Vickers, who was a proper engineer, he said, "You can't build racing cars like that. This is ridiculous. Why don't you let me do it?" So he got a job, and he then stayed with HWM until they stopped racing. He's now 94, and I'm delighted to say he came to the book launch last night full of beans. I, when I was doing my research, sat in his kitchen with his wife making me endless cups of tea, and I must have been with him for 9 or 10 hours with my tape recorder going, and the stories just kept coming. And it is amazing that if you can speak to people who were actually there at the time, you get an extraordinary depth of detail. John Heath's second wife, who was with him at the Mealy Mealy in 1956, and indeed was sitting by his bed in that little Italian hospital when he died. She is still alive. She's an old lady living in Ibiza. And her memory was fantastic, and she described what it was like getting the news. They were at Brescia when John disappeared off on the race, getting the news that he'd crashed, rushing to his hospital through all the crowds because they had to follow the route of the race to get there, and then being with him for the last 3 days of his life. All of this, she told me on the telephone from Ibiza, absolutely sharp memories. And of course, this was an enormous help in making the book more than just a list of race results.
Mm. And of course, it paints the colour of a very different time and some very different circumstances, but also, you know, as they often refer to it, a golden age of racing.
Well, I think so. I mean, I'm now in my mid-70s, and I first saw racing. My dad took me to a motor race when I was seven, which was, you know, in the early 50s. And I actually saw my first HWM at Goodwood on Easter Monday 1956. They used to have the big Goodwood meeting each year on Easter Monday. And I, of course, followed it all. I even had a dinky toy on an HWM. And they only made 19 HWMs, of which 17 still survive. But, of course, they made about 20,000 dinky HWMs. So you could say they were the most successful HWMs.
And you have one yourself, as you said, and it's an ex-Stirling Moss one. What are they like to drive and fire up?
Well, the thing is, if you're driving a racing car that's 70 years old, it is very different from anything you would drive today, whether a road car or indeed a racing car. They are very primitive. They are crude. They have very little braking. In terms of horsepower, a lot of these kind of Formula 2 cars were no quicker than a really good Golf GTI would be today. But of course, they had very little grip, very primitive suspension, so very little road holding, not many brakes, nothing like seat belts, you were completely unprotected, perching on top of the chassis with very little bodywork around you. If you had an accident, you would either get thrown out and have a miraculous escape, or you would die in horrible ways, like you would fall out of the car into the road and another person would run you over. Crash helmets weren't necessary until 1952. A lot of drivers didn't bother with them until then. And the crash helmets then, when they did come in, were made of cork and were really pretty flimsy. In every way, it was a different era. For those of your listeners who get this book, I think almost my favourite photograph in it, and we ran it over a full double-page spread, is a picture of two cars, George Abacasis in a Bugatti that day, not in an HWM, and Prince Bira in a Maserati, and they're going down a straight in a race in Belgium. And the crowd are lining the road, and there's just a piece of string which is meant to hold the crowd back. And these two cars going down the straight are probably doing about 155 miles an hour, and the road is very narrow. It was absolutely a different world, and people would be horrified now. They'd be horrified by the death toll. They'd be horrified by the danger. They would most of all be horrified by the fact that not only were the drivers risking their lives, but the public, who'd probably paid, you know, a few pence to come in and watch, they were risking their lives as well. And that's really what changed it in the early 50s, when people focused on the fact that it is morally wrong to start killing members of the public. If you kill yourself, you're racing voluntarily. But you can't kill members of the public. And really, like the banning of the Mealy Mealy, that was the start of the change, which has, thank goodness, made motor racing very much safer.
The book is called John, George and the HWMs, the first racing team to fly the flag for Britain. It's by Simon Teller. It's out now on Evro Publishing. Simon, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you have a website? I imagine you do. Do you do the social media thing?
I'm ashamed to say I don't, and I don't. I sort of crop up on various websites, but I think there's a thing called Wikipedia, which I'm sure you all know. And I think if you want to see various people have put up stuff on Wikipedia about me, some of which is accurate. So you can always have a look at me on Wikipedia.
And what are you up to next, apart from heading towards the Grand Prix? I suppose the British Grand Prix.
Yeah, well, I'm competing in my HWM in hill climbs. Was out last weekend at Chelsea Walsh. This weekend, I'm lucky enough to have a 1937 Bentley with a rather elegant Gurney Nutting body. And this year, as a lot of your listeners may know, it's the 100th anniversary of Bentley. They started in 1919, and there's a great gathering at Burley House in Lincolnshire, where there are going to be hundreds and hundreds of Bentleys all turning up to celebrate that 100th anniversary. And I shall be getting into my Bentley with my picnic hamper at about 5 o'clock tomorrow morning and setting sail for Lincolnshire.
Absolutely marvellous. The book is called John George and the HWMs. It's by Simon Taylor. Simon, thank you so much for your time today.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.